Welcome to the deep dive. Forget what you might think about arguments that point to the natural world, you know, the ones looking at stars or biology.
Right.
Today, we're really plunging straight into pure thought, exploring, a truly unique argument for God's existence. This isn't about faith. It's about logic, starting from the very idea of God.
Exactly. We're diving into the ontological argument. And what makes it so different is it doesn't rely on observations about, say, the universe's beginning, like the cosmological argument, or apparent design, which is the teleological argument. No, this one takes a totally different path.
Right. The basic idea, if I've got this straight, is that just by understanding the definition of God as like the most perfect being imaginable, the greatest thing you can possibly conceive, you can actually show that such a being has to exist. It's kind of a mind-bending concept, isn't it? Could existence be baked into the definition?
It is a bit mind-bending, and it's an idea with surprising staying power. St. Anselm first cooked it up way back in the 11th century.
Wow, 11th century.
Yeah, but it didn't just fade away. You have thinkers like René Descartes picking it up centuries later, and even in the 20th century, philosophers like Norman Malcolm, Charles Hartshorne, Alvin Plantinga, they've all developed their own pretty sophisticated versions. So there's clearly something compelling about this line of reasoning.
Okay, so our plan today is to really get into this. We'll start with Anselm's original arguments. He actually had a couple of slightly different takes, right?
Mm-hmm.
He did. Yeah. And then we'll jump ahead to Plantinga's modern modal version, which sounds pretty influential. So yeah, get ready to maybe have some assumptions challenged as we deep dive into the concept of God itself.
Sounds like a plan. Let's start with Anselm. His starting point, as you said, is this definition. God is that than which none greater can be conceived. Let's maybe just call this being G to make things a bit easier.
Okay, yeah, G for the greatest conceivable being. Good idea. So his first argument, it hinges on this idea that, well, that existing in reality is somehow better or greater than just existing in your head as an idea. He uses that pizza example, which I love. You know, you're dreaming of the perfect pizza.
Mm-hmm, dripping with cheese.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Would you rather just have that perfect thought of a pizza or the actual hot, delicious pizza right there?
Well, the choice seems obvious, right? The real pizza, definitely. And Anselm uses this to say, look, for things we consider good or perfect, reality adds something. It's inherently better, more complete to have the real deal than just the concept.
Okay, I'm following.
Okay.
So here's the twist then. Anselm says, if this greatest conceivable being, G, only existed in our minds, then it wouldn't actually be the greatest conceivable being, because you could immediately think of something greater, that same being, but actually existing in reality.
Mm-hmm.
And like we just said with the pizza, real existence seems greater.
Precisely. So if G only existed as a thought, you could always improve on it conceptually by adding real existence. This means your initial thought wasn't really of that than which none greater can be conceived after all. It was missing something crucial.
Ah, so it's like a contradiction. To say G is the greatest conceivable thing, but, oh, it doesn't actually exist. Well, that doesn't work, because a G that does exist would be greater. So for the definition to hold, G must exist in reality.
Exactly. It's a logical necessity stemming from the definition itself. Existence, for Anselm, is a kind of perfection or a great making quality. To lack existence is to lack a perfection. Therefore, the greatest conceivable being must possess existence. That's the essence of his first argument.
Okay. But then there's the second version you mentioned, the modal one. How does that differ?
Right. His second argument shifts the focus slightly. It asks us to think about the conceivability of God's non-existence. Can you even properly imagine a being whose non-existence is inconceivable?
Inconceivable non-existence.
Think about it. If a being were truly the absolute greatest possible being, wouldn't its existence be sort of fundamental? Like, it couldn't not exist. Its existence would be part of its very nature.
It reminds me of that line from The Princess Bride, inconceivable.
Huh. Yes, it does have that vibe, doesn't it? But in a serious philosophical sense.
Right. So if a being's non-existence is truly inconceivable,
then Anselm argues, if you can even entertain that concept, a being whose non-existence is impossible, you've acknowledged its possibility in some sense. Now, suppose that being didn't actually exist. Well, then you would be conceiving of its non-existence, wouldn't you? Which directly contradicts the initial premise that its non-existence is inconceivable.
Okay, wait. So if I can think of a being that must exist, meaning its non-existence is unthinkable, then it has to exist. Because if it didn't, I could think of its non-existence, which violates the starting point.
Exactly. It's a neat logical loop. It leads to the idea of necessary existence. This being, G, can't be conceived as non-existing, therefore it must exist necessarily. Its existence isn't contingent on anything else.
And that's the modal part, dealing with necessity and possibility.
That's right. It's about logical modes, necessity, possibility, contingency. And just as a historical footnote, it was actually Immanuel Kant, much later, who officially labeled this the ontological argument, setting it apart from the cosmological and teleological ones.
Interesting how these things get named later. Okay, so we have Anselm's arguments. Powerful stuff. But surely people pushed back.
Oh, absolutely. Almost immediately. One of the most famous early objections came from a contemporary of Anselm, a monk named Gonillo.
Ah, yes, the island guy.
The very same. Gonillo said, okay, Anselm, imagine the most perfect island conceivable. Perfect beaches, perfect weather, perfect everything.
Sounds pretty good right about now.
Doesn't it? But Gonillo's point was, just because I can conceive of this perfect island down to the last perfect coconut tree doesn't mean that island actually exists somewhere in the ocean. My ability to imagine perfection doesn't just poof it into reality.
Yeah, that seems like a solid point. If Anselm's logic works for God, why not for a perfect island or a perfect pizza or a perfect anything?
That's the heart of Gonillo's critique. Anselm's response, though, was quite specific. He argued that his logic only applies to that unique concept, that than which none greater can be conceived. He believed that necessary existence is a perfection inherent only in the concept of the absolute greatest being, not in contingent things like islands, no matter how perfect we imagine them to be.
So he's saying there's something fundamentally different about the concept of God compared to the concept of a perfect island. That existence is uniquely tied to God's definition.
That was his defense. That maximal greatness includes necessary existence in a way that maximal islandness doesn't. But, you know, critics weren't and still aren't entirely convinced. Many feel Gonillo hit on a real vulnerability that the argument seems like it could be used illicitly.
Right, feels a bit like a philosophical magic trick if you're not careful. Now, moving forward in time, Kant had a major objection too, didn't he? Something about existence not being a predicate.
Yes. Kant's critique is probably the most famous and influential. He argued that existence is not a real predicate. What he meant is that existence isn't a quality or characteristic you add to a concept, like saying a triangle has three sides.
Okay. So, like, if I describe this mug, it's white, it's ceramic, it holds coffee.
Mm-hmm.
It would be weird to then add, and it exists, as just another feature on the list.
Exactly. Kant's point is that when you describe the mug's properties, you're already assuming its existence, at least conceptually, in order to talk about its properties. Existence isn't another property alongside white or ceramic. It's more like the condition that allows it to have properties in the first place.
So applying that to God,
mm-hmm.
when we say God is omnipotent, omniscient, etc., we're listing predicates. Kant would say we're already assuming God's conceptual existence to even list those.
Mm.
We can't then use existence itself as one more predicate to somehow prove God's reality.
That's the core of Kant's objection. He's saying Anselm treats exists like is powerful or is good, but it functions differently in language and logic. It's not a feature within the concept, but asserts the concept's connection to reality.
That's a really subtle but powerful point. But has that gone unchallenged? Because we do talk about things existing or not existing, right? Like, dragons don't exist, or my car keys exist, hopefully somewhere in this room.
That's the counter-argument. Critics of Kant say, hold on, we do predicate existence or non-existence. We talk about fictional characters. Sherlock Holmes lives at 221B Baker Street, but he doesn't exist in reality. We distinguish between concepts and reality all the time using existence language. So why can't we say God has attributes X, Y, Z, and also predicate actual existence to that concept, unlike, say, unicorns?
So the debate about whether existence is a predicate and what that even means is still ongoing.
Very much so. It's a deep philosophical issue. And this brings us nicely to the more modern takes, especially Alvin Plantinga's version.
Right, Plantinga. He uses modal logic, which we touched on, possibility and necessity.
And something called possible worlds.
Exactly. Possible worlds analysis is just the way philosophers talk about different ways things could have been. Our actual world is one possible world, but we can conceive of others' worlds where, I don't know, dinosaurs still roam, or where I chose a different career path.
Okay, got it. So how does Plantinga use this?
Well, his argument, simplified, starts with a premise like this. It is possible that a maximally great being exists, meaning there is at least one possible world where such a being possessing maximal excellence, like omnipotence, omniscience, perfect goodness, exists.
Okay, that seems plausible. We can at least imagine a possible scenario where such a being exists, even if we doubt it exists in our world. That's the starting point. Premise one, maximal greatness is possible. Now, premise two is the kicker. Plantinga argues that maximal greatness inherently involves existing necessarily. A truly maximally great being couldn't just happen to exist in some worlds but not others. To be maximally great, it must have maximal excellence, including existence, in every possible world.
Whoa, okay, let me process that. If it's maximally great, its greatness can't be limited to just some scenarios. It has to extend across all possibilities, including having the perfection of existence in all of them.
That's the idea. If it only existed contingently in some worlds, you could conceive of a greater being, one that existed necessarily in all worlds. So maximal greatness entails necessary existence.
Okay. So if it's possible for a maximally great being to exist, premise one, and maximal greatness means existing in all possible worlds, premise two,
then it follows logically that if such a being exists in any possible world, it must exist in all possible worlds.
And since our actual world is one of the possible worlds,
then a maximally great being must exist in our actual world. Boom.
Okay. That is elegant. And sneaky. It shifts the burden, doesn't it? Instead of proving existence directly, it asks if maximal greatness is even possible. If you grant the possibility, the logic seems to force the conclusion of actual existence.
Precisely. And that's where the main pushback comes. The whole argument hinges on that first premise. Is it really coherent? Is it truly possible for a maximally great being to exist?
Right. Because some philosophers argue the very concept is contradictory, don't they? Like the whole omnipotence paradox or the free will versus omniscience issue we mentioned earlier.
Yes. Thinkers like Kenneth Hema, C.D. Broad, even Sartre touched on these kinds of potential incoherencies. Can a being be all-powerful and all-knowing and perfectly good and grant genuine freedom? Some argue these attributes clash logically. For example, if God knows the future infallibly, how can creatures be truly free in a way that allows for alternate possibilities?
That's the classic one. It feels like knowing the choice removes the freedom of choosing.
It does feel that way, particularly if you hold a specific view of free will, what philosophers call libertarian free will, where freedom requires genuine open alternatives. However, there are other ways to understand free will, compatibilist views, where God's foreknowledge might not necessarily contradict human freedom.
So the strength of that objection depends a bit on your underlying assumptions about free will.
It does. And, you know, while these paradoxes are challenging and important to think about, personally, I don't think anyone has definitively proven that the core concept of a maximally great being is logically impossible or incoherent. There are sophisticated responses to these alleged contradictions.
So in your view, Plantinga's argument stands as a strong contender, even if that first premise remains debatable.
I'd say so. I find it a very powerful formulation, perhaps stronger than Anselm's originals, precisely because it isolates that key question of possibility. But is it a knockout proof? No. It remains, quite rightly, a major topic of discussion and debate in philosophy of religion.
Wow. We've certainly traced quite a journey. From Anselm's medieval insights right up to Plantinga's modern logic games with possible worlds. It's amazing how this purely a priori argument, just based on concepts, has endured.
It really is unique in that way. It bypasses empirical evidence entirely and tries to reason directly from the definition of God to God's reality. Whether it succeeds or not, it forces us to think deeply about concepts, perfection, and existence itself.
And clearly the conversation isn't over. The objections, the counter-objections, the refinements. It shows how tricky, but also how fascinating this whole line of reasoning is.
Absolutely. It touches on some of the most fundamental questions we can ask.
So a final thought for our listeners to chew on. Even if you find flaws in the specific logical steps of Anselm's or Plantinga's arguments, does the very fact that we can conceive of ultimate perfection, of this being than which none greater can be conceived, tell us anything significant? Does our capacity for such a concept point towards anything beyond our own minds? Something to ponder. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.